KBOO hosts a monthly film series called KBOO at the Clinton, hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll screen the film Undocumented on Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. Undocumented is a documentary about a 13-year-old who travels from Colombia to join his parents in America and his life becoming a surgeon. It is a story of struggle, loss, danger, courage, and love. Again, that's a film screening of Undocumented, Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feet to the Fire campaign and protest on Saturday, August 11th at 10 a.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse in Portland. The monthly Feet to the Fire campaign is part of a national campaign started by Protect Our Stolen Treasures out of Detroit to hold district attorneys accountable for protecting us against police violence and hate crimes. This peaceful protest outside a county courthouse calls for justice for those lost to police violence and hate crimes. Again, that's the Feet to the Fire campaign and protest this month, Saturday, August 11th, at 10 a.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse, 1021 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to The Lit Fantastic, a show about authors and their obsessions. I'm your host, Neil Akin, and today we're speaking with the poet T.J. Jarrett. T.J. is a writer and software developer in Nashville, Tennessee. Her work has been published or forthcoming in Poetry, African American Review, Boston Review, Beloit Poetry Journal, Kowloo Diagram, Third Toast, and many, many more. She is the author of a debut collection, Ain't No Grave, which was published by New Issues Press in 2013, as well as her second collection, Zion, which won the Crab Orchard Open Competition and was published by the Southern Illinois University Press in the fall of 2014. Part of the reason why I wanted to do this interview with TJ was because both of us come from a background as programmers and then also found ourselves writing poetry. In this conversation, we end up talking about her particular mixture of obsessions. She's obsessed with restoring hardwood floors, with the idea and the experience of lived space and architecture, and the ways in which this feeds into our understanding of language, whether it is the languages we use to communicate one with another as human beings, or the languages we engage with as programmers to communicate and transform what we understand from machines.
I mean, it's well past normal, like, oh wow, that was a very satisfying thing. It's like, I actually go to friends' houses to like fix their floors. It's that and like tile, because I just, yeah, tile and grout, it drives me nuts.
Okay, so this is not just merely refinishing your own floors. You actually go out and seek
it's
out opportunities.
Like, I house sit, and people know that I actually have a friend who I think she plans to have her floors in horrible shape because she knows I can't take it.
And then you'll arrive and you'll somehow magically transform their floors into this beautiful, pristine wood finished floor.
Yep.
Wow. So how did this start? I mean, this is one day you wake up and you decide, I love finished wood floors and I'm going to...
I love wood floors in general. I mean, like everyone, I mean, who doesn't? I mean, they're beautiful and, you know, it's, and when they're clean, they're awesome. I don't know. I think it's the ritual of doing it. It's the whole, like, because it's a multi-layered process. Like, it depends on, like, how the floor is finished, what you get to, you know, what you get to, like, take up dirt off of it, if you need to, like, actually, like, sand and refinish it, if it's that bad. There are steps, and they're pretty hard and fast steps, so you don't have to really think about it. You just kind of go through the motions of doing it.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, is there a particular like floor you go back to? You think, this is where I got my start. This is what I started on, and I just kind of fell in love with this process. Or did you kind of begrudgingly fall into this and then discover a love for later?
There are ironies. I hate Home Depot. Like, I absolutely, in my soul, hate it. And so anytime I'm in there, something has happened. But I had to refinish some floors when I lived in Boston because they were awful, and I could not live with them anymore. And I was having a building refurbished. I was working for a company. We were having a building refurbished, and I complained to the general contractor. And he's like, well, I don't have anyone to give to do it, but like, here's my 175. I'm going to give you some steps and some chemicals. You knock yourself out.
Well, hopefully not literally.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, kind of, because that's like a really, like, that machine is kind of weird because it it scrubs. And so, like, as it's scrubbing, it kind of moves. And it moves, if you don't know how to drive it, it moves quite violently, and you can, like, take out a wall with it.
So you can finish the floors and take out the walls with the same machine.
Yep. You certainly can. Yeah. He walked me through it. He walked me through how to do it, and I was like, "Well, that's pretty awesome," and I always felt really satisfied and happy. And so, I was like, "Wow, that's a home project that actually worked." And so then I go from that to
So do you
know that I will? Yeah.
Do you actually own your own machine for doing this?
Yeah, I do.
Well, that's investment. That's
it's investment. No, it's bad. It's not good. It is not healthy. I don't do it like I. It's not like it's something. It's like a quarterly project, and then I'll begrudge it and like wait until I actually, because there are hardwood floors in my house too. So I'm like, and then I'll just do it.
Do you find?
It's like a week. It's like if I'm going room to room, it's like I'll do like one room a night because I obviously have other things to do. But yeah.
So what do you find most satisfying about this?
It's the removal of layers. There's the layer of dirt. If you actually have to like remove, a layer of, it's finding what's underneath. And so like, if you want to change the color of the floor, you're actually gonna have to sand it, and you have to, you start out with a low grit, work your way to a higher grit. And then you actually like carpet pad on the new stain, and then lay the poly on top of it. It's the removal of layers and then applying layers on top. Removing the old and bringing out the new. So yeah, I would probably say that's possibly, there's some metaphor in there about my life. I'm not quite exactly sure what that is, but yeah.
Well, I mean, it sounds to me like the way you describe it is partly like in the vein of art restoration, like the sense that there is something to be rescued or to be restored or kind of brought to light that's been lost. But then there's also a part of it that feels a little bit like a sculpture, which is also, in the process of transforming something. You see the raw material and you see what could it become with this, application of technique, this use of this knowledge and these tools.
Yep.
Yeah. So do you find yourself then, do you look back over sort of your history of working on these different floors and thinking of particular homes or particular floors that you feel satisfied, really like proud of the accomplishment of what you did to restore?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I have a friend of mine who has dogs who have just destroyed her floor. But she's got three of them. They're big dogs. That's what they do. And I don't know where she was, or she was on vacation somewhere. And like, I actually had to text her in the middle of the night after I finally got the finish down. I'm like, this is the last time you'll ever see it this good. I think you need a picture of this.
So what's the oldest floor you restored then?
It's probably my first one. It was it's an old pine, and I had this house. I was living in this house that was like 108 years old, and I had no idea what I was in for. It was the most complicated, awful, horrible thing I'd ever done. Because I started thinking that, okay, maybe it's just, maybe there's just like there's a finish on it and I just need to clean off the finish. No, it was actually like living in the house and sanding and refinishing. And then somehow making sure that I was done before my landlord got back to look at it. Because I was like, oh, I'm going to do this little part. This is horrible. and it was so bad that I had to get it done. So I was like going to work, then going to bed at 3 a.m, having done one room, and then going to the other one. It was awful, absolutely awful. But I did it in like a period of a couple, like it was including that, I probably did it in like a week. It was a week with like, you know, it's like 1500 square feet and having to sleep at a friend's house because you can't sleep while you have like, while you're put, like while you're laying down finished, you can't sleep in that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, I've kind of fallen in love with the finished wood floor, really well polished floor. When I was living in Los Angeles in Koreatown, there was this one apartment I was in that was a 1930s former hotel. And had this like 10-foot ceiling room with the original hardwood floors. Somehow the previous tenant had lived there the entire time through all, like she had been this older lady that had been there forever and ever and ever. And so she had lived through the entire period in the 60s, I mean in the 70s and 80s when someone thought it would be brilliant to put carpet like, all over
it. Carpet on top?
There was never carpet on top of it. So it was the original gorgeous hardwood floors. I walked into it when I was looking for apartments, and that was the first thing I noticed was the color and sort of the character of the floor. And I fell in love. I thought, this is the place I have to live. But yeah, and this weekend I was actually staying at a friend's house who's restored a 1915 home, you know, out on the coast of Oregon. And again, sort of the original, both the hardwood floors, but then also there's a, I can't remember the name of it. It's not linoleum, but it's something earlier, like the earliest form of linoleum where you actually paint the design on top of it.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of it. Yeah. I forget the name of it. It's like Antique or something. I forget what it's called.
But yeah, so when they were in the process of restoring their home, they discovered like each of the bedrooms had been done like that. And there was these amazing patterns that got revealed.
Oh, nice.
So that excitement of like, wow, look at this hidden treasure that's been like lying here for decades and no one's
noticed. And it's so strange to actually, you know, there's a part of me that always looks down a little bit that I just want to see like what kind of, you know, what are we walking on? Like what's, you know, what's beneath us? Is that, you know, it's like, how important is that? Just, you know, yeah, it's interesting how we're like excited about these, like these literally something you're literally going to walk on.
Yeah. I think what's really interesting to me about hardwood floors too is they're not perfect. They're not pristine. They are sort of the engraved history of the previous tenants. You know, you see like every moment that someone dropped a cigarette and burned a spot on the floor, every time someone, you know, scraped, you know, a heavy piece of furniture across the floor and then it's been filled in, you know, the finish has filled it in and now it's, you know, now it takes on a new mark, a new tattoo, a new part of the story is on the floor.
Exactly.
And it's interesting how it becomes a thing of beauty, whereas if that same thing happened to, you know, your linoleum floor, you would say, oh no, we've got to replace the whole thing.
Well, or you just get another square and you replace that square.
That's true. You just drop it in
lots space. Of, you know, it's like, or if like you have something happen to carpet, you can just cut out a little piece and then replace it from a donor piece somewhere in your closet and put the, you know, and move on with your life. There are a lot of steps with like actually even if someone, you know, someone burned the floor, depending on how, you know, how deep that burn is, you can, you know, you can actually get it out, you know, provided you, it's like it's not so deep that you can't level it with the rest or feather it out with the rest of the floor. Yeah, I also find that it's really interesting to me how, and this is something I admire about people, there are some people who are really good at building spaces for people to move through in a way that I am not really, I'm not that person. I'm comfortable. I like to be comfortable, but I'm not, you know, I'm not a builder of spaces for people to inhabit. I kind of think of my poems to do more of that work. And I think it's a friend of mine who, she does restaurants. And so every restaurant has to be this space that's comfortable and people want to spend time there. And they want to eat and share time with their friends. And a lot of thought goes into that. including what the flooring looks like, what the crown molding looks like, what the ceiling's going to look like. And I'm fascinated by people who are knowledgeable and understand those things, that every space is built for someone to inhabit it and not just to stand back and admire. Yeah, it's fascinating to me. But I'm really, mine's really specifically, specifically about hardwoods, but yeah.
Yeah, so this idea of like, the construction of a space that we inhabit, you know, years ago I read like a book called, I remember what it was. It was the House and the Temple. That's what it was. And basically it's an architectural book that is also a literary book and also a philosophical book about like how space is constructed and different spaces constructed and, you know, how different architectural elements, you know, create different moods or different atmospheres. So if you want some place to feel like it's a sacred space, then you would use these type of elements. You would create like a sense of loftiness, or you might add, you know, some other element that like brings in more light or more sense of like a vastness to it. So it's just really interesting to me, like what different things are done. You know, and you go into like other cultures, that sense of how a space is constructed takes on some really deeply spiritual significance. The in Chinese culture, for instance, you know, with the whole philosophy of feng shui, which is about, I mean, literally it means wind and water, and has to do with how energy moves through a space and how we move through a space. And so there's definitely a difference between like a room or a home that's been designed with the sense of like how energy or how people pass through that space with ease or are interrupted and disrupted as they move through a space. But yeah, so I find like that's a deeply interesting subject to explore, that sense of space, the sense of the lived spaces we occupy.
And actually I was thinking about that, and particularly in terms of poems, I spend a lot of time, if you think about the poetic line as a unit of measure of dimension to a poem, I always think of how do I interrupt it? Mm-hmm. What kind of velocity will I bring to each line? I use a lot of caesuras to interrupt the rhythm. Mm-hmm. When you think that this unit is going to be the same one to the other, and they're not. Mm-hmm. And I use them intentionally to stop that movement in the space. I think of poetry architecturally, very, very architecturally, when it comes to things like that, because I think that, you know, there's different kinds of space. And things that one would take for granted, like the line, for example, or the stanza, for that matter. You're kind of in this, and I too am swept up in like the world of the couplet lately. Mm-hmm. But I find quartets to be quite stodgy, big, huge kind of lunks of space to move through. Where I find couplets a lot faster to move through. But yeah, I think it's, and maybe the impulse to like love cleaning floor, maybe it comes from that same thing of the uncovering and the unfurling. I don't know.
Well, I think there is some, you know, as we've been talking, I've been thinking about that in terms of like, I think what you're talking about like the restoring of these floors, the excavation or restoration or revelation of what's there, that feels very much like a discussion of revision, you know, of like what we do to the draft of the poem to try to discover what's really there. We look at the raw material and we see the shape of it and we think, I think I know what's underneath this. I just have to work at it with the right procedure, with the right process, and I can find what's lurking beneath there.
And also what's very interesting is like wood floors, brand new wood floors, are quite not interesting. It takes a while for, depending on the type of stain you have, to really settle into the pores of it and to really tell you what color it's going to be. Mm-hmm. You have to literally, it has to be lived in for a second for it to actually get its character. I'm not even interested in, you know, you can clean things. I mean, you clean it, fine, whatever. But it's not, I don't find it to be an interesting project until it's something that needs, like, that actually needs help. And to come back to what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, and I think it has a little bit to, maybe a lot to do with imperfection, you know.
Yeah.
There's something that we're drawn to work over something that feels imperfect or raw or rough in some way. Even, you know, that it, maybe it's not entirely broken, but there's something that needs work. Something that feels like it doesn't require us. Doesn't really, you know, that to me feels boring, right? I do think too there's like an interesting parallel too with jade with you know, something my uncle taught me, one of my uncles in Taiwan. He gave me two pieces of jade. He gave me a newly carved piece of jade, and then he gave me something that he had owned for a very, very long time. And the new piece of jade, all the lines are very crisp. Everything is sharp. Everything, you know, it's clearly defined, and yet it feels kind of soulless, I guess. The old piece of jade is worn smooth, and there's actually a Chinese idiom about, literally the idiom for referring to wasting time or idling or like just doing nothing is moyu, or to rub jade. And literally that's what people would do, is they'd sit around with a piece of jade in their hand and they would rub it in their hands, and over years of doing that, it would break down the hard lines on the jade and make it smoother and smoother. But also the oils in the hand would change the color of the jade. A piece of old jade is not only beautiful, but it's the product of like decades of contact with the human being.
Well, I think it's, my grandmother always had this, she would always talk about how a place remembers a thing. And how the body itself does in fact mark the spaces that it inhabits. Because you think that suddenly, you know, it's like you walk into a house that's empty, that there's, you know, she had an absolute sense, and it's not in the sense of ghosts, but maybe a little bit in the sense of ghosts, but in the sense of the space that people live through can be marked by their emotions, by, you know, things that happen, and the space itself remembers the things that happen there. And there are, you know, ordinary sacred places. And in the context she was speaking about, it, she was speaking about lynching. Every lynching tree remembers its place, but that in the sense of, you know, in the sense of trauma, trauma to a place. There's also a sense of joy to a place, and her house that she always wanted to have, the brick should know that they were happy in that space. And, you know, again, it's like a house is like everything else. A house is like, you know, it's in contact with your body as you, like, you know, pad to the kitchen in the middle of the night. It fascinates me. And maybe that's why I like wood, just because it's a natural material. And it's going to be around. It's going to endure for a second, but it had endured before that for many, many years before it becomes, you know, before it comes your floor too. So.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. Sometimes we forget about that the wood that we see, you know, really this is its second or third life.
Exactly.
You know, it's been other things. It's been a tree, and then it's been, you know, an unshaped board, and then it finds a place in our home. In some homes, the remains of a previous home or a previous piece of furniture, like, actually I was just thinking of the Decanon exhibit, all the boxes that we use and a lot of the elements that we use in our exhibit are all from recovered wood. And there's like a lot of pieces that come from an old paddle boat. So, you know, it's lived now three lives at least, you know. it's been a tree, it's been a paddle boat board, and it's, you know, and now it's shelves and boxes. And so it's interesting, how that plays out. you know, the other thing, we were talking about this and the idea that the place remembers, you know, the people and the things that happened there. There's something that our good ancestor, both of us being programmers, our good ancestor Charles Babbage once said in his Ninth Bridgewater Treatise, which is his foray into theology, actually. He says this really interesting thing. He says that every word and every action that we perform or that we utter, is the vibrations of it are recorded forever in the particles of the air. And if we had a machine or a technology advanced enough, we could replay everything that had ever been said and ever been done. And he says it will be out of the very particles of the air that will form the book of remembrance from which we will be judged.
Wow. That's stimulating and depressing.
Yes, yes. Well, he then takes this further, and it's interesting. He uses this as part of his condemnation of slavery and one of his footnotes. And he talks about sort of the ways in which the slavers would throw their cargo, you know, the actual people into the waves rather than be caught for illegal trafficking. And he says, you know, in some final day, it's their words, every particle of the air will, and every particle of the ocean will scream out against these people in judgment. But yeah, so this idea of like the, you know, spaces remembering everything that has been said and done, it's a really powerful idea. I'm interested, you know, what other ways do you see, do you find ways in which your own work, so you have this very physical labor of doing this restoration of these wood floors. Mm-hmm. How do you see that relating to the work that you do by day? You work in the field of technology software engineer, which is very intangible.
We actually call it, I call it a data sanitation engineer. I prefer that term. A lot of my days is spent not just being fed data, because it's, a lot of things come out of the unexpectedness. You happen to hit me in a particular day where I found a ton of unexpected data. But having understanding about the different types of data that flow through and come to me, either by exception handling for that data, or, you know, having real discoveries about how the data comes to us as well, coming through the pipeline. And then kind of a lot of the things I do is some data mining in that. And so going through that and finding new connections to in large data sets, different connections in terms of, you know, because if someone has this particular diagnosis, these are their, you know, their co-occurring conditions. Mm-hmm. And you find a lot of really interesting, very useful data that comes in there.
Do you turn to like the physical labor as a relief from a day spent in the cerebral?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It is, I don't have to think about it. I mean, you make a plan for lots of things, but then, yeah, there are just times you're just kind of going by feel. I feel that way about cooking. I like cooking for that reason. You're just kind of going by feel when you know, it's like you could measure temperature, but like the perfect firmness for a fish is really a matter of like, you know, when it hits back at you, when you touch it. and there's a tactile kind of, and maybe that's and I'm not sure if it's because I'm naturally a sensualist. I believe in like a world that I can touch and feel and understand. Or maybe it's because I spend so much time in my head that I need something that just responds by feel and touch, that doesn't have to tax the already overtaxed brain cells that do all the logic all day. So I just need to get out of my head for a second.
Yeah. It sounds, now I'm guessing then that are you the type of person that cooks without a recipe? And
almost always.
Yeah, because I think it's kind of interesting. You know, it's like a recipe is basically a program, and yet...
It's chemistry,
yeah. Right? We follow this and we make this thing happen. But I think what you allude to is it turns out that every fish is entirely different.
Everyone.
Every single one is different, and every single dish that you work on ends up being a little different. Every single oven element works differently, or if you have a gas stove, you know, the burners all burn slightly differently.
Every plant is different. Every hot pepper is not quite the same strength or weak. You know, it's and I function that way because I spend so much time. Because you can't control everything, for crying out loud. So there's got to be a point where you step back and you can actually, I kind of go by guidelines, but yeah, I'm not a chemist when it comes to my food. Kind of sort of chemist when it comes to the floors, though. Kind of sort of. In terms of like how much, you know, if someone's been taking poor care of something, if someone's been putting like, there are like restorative products that you can put on floors that make it shiny for like 10 minutes before it just gets marked up and dirty and crap.
Yeah.
Figuring out exactly like how strong do I need to make something to strip this off? What's the combination between like agitating it off and, you know, letting something dwell on it? That takes a little bit of thought, but not a ton. I mean, just, that's also, I've done it enough times. I'm like, okay, I can do this. But
So it, in a way, it's not exactly chemistry as much as it's you move into something that's more automatic, less dictated by like logic and a conscious effort to do something, but closer in many respects to how one might paint or how one might compose poetry, perhaps.
Exactly. It's an experiential kind of thing. It should be something that, and it's also something I enjoy doing, which is not necessarily what my job is every day.
And on this point, I heartily commiserate. I have been there.
Yeah.
Different fields of programming and data, but it's a similar slog. And
some days it just is.
Some days are just brutal, and grateful to leave. I had a colleague who after the workday was done would go home to an apartment where there was no computer, and she raised rabbits and she rang bells in a church choir.
Wow.
And she was like, she says, I don't want to deal with technology when I come home. I just want to be completely, you know, analog, just be in the world and sort of relate to the things, not machines.
Yeah. I do not know what's wrong with my dog. I'm very sorry. Losing his mind. I have friends of mine who like raise chickens.
Mm-hmm.
I have friends who do those elaborate board games. You know, those like, I forget the name of that game. It's like really big in like the 90s.
Are you talking like, about Settlers of Catan? No, Warhammer 40K. Oh, yes.
Yeah, so no, they're big, old school.
Big,
gamers.
big, you know, lots of miniatures. It's basically war gaming for, I mean, it's an even, I don't know which is geekier. the fantasy element of wargaming, or like just the tabletop wargaming, which oddly enough I did have a childhood when I was briefly involved with tabletop wargaming. I used to have soldier minis and like this is a really sad confession. I at one point had a book on solo wargaming, so you could run your own battles.
Wait,
against
yourself. Wait, you can do that by yourself? You can't do that, really?
There were dice rolls for it, and so you could set up elaborate battles between armies and roll it out.
That is embarrassing.
That is true. So, hermit mode was there.
Yeah.
I graduated to something more social, and I became more involved in like tabletop role playing games that actually involved talking to other people.
You know, that's better. It's better. You're working your way out of it.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. If you're just joining us, I'm Neil Aiken, and this is The Lit Fantastic. We're speaking to the poet T.J. Jarrett about her obsession with restoring hardwood floors and how that takes her to a larger obsession, an interest in the places and spaces that we live. Let's return to the conversation now.
it's amazing how many people I know in technology and the weird things that we do to get away from it.
Yeah.
Because our entire lives are, you know, like, I had a dream. Actually, this happened a couple, like, last Monday, Monday before last. I had this horrible dream that it was a dream. I'm in the water and there's a baby floating by in a basket in the water. And it's crying and I pick up the baby and I ask the baby if it's okay. And it continues to cry. And I ask the baby its name and it says its name is Production. And I woke up in a cold sweat and my production server had gone down.
No.
That's the kind, and I'm that dialed in. And so that was weird. That was last Monday. And then on Saturday, my SE took a nap and had something very similar happen to him. I don't know what that is. But yeah, you find yourself, you're so dialed into making certain that everyone's served, that you just need to like feed whatever it is in you that you can feed that makes you happy. And if it's something that's relatively mindless, so be it.
I have never had an allegorical dream about coding. I have had dreams where I did code.
Exactly.
I have coded for like my entire dream and solved the problem I was working on at work, only to wake up and realize that none of that mattered because I'd done it in my dream and I had to go to work and actually write all that code now.
I have had algorithm dreams where I'm thinking about how am I going to best build, you know, this particular object to pass data through, and I've definitely dreamt about that. I've had several where you're just dreaming in code, which is weird.
It is weird.
Which I guess it's kind of like the dreams where you're dreaming in French somehow, or you're dreaming in Spanish, and it happens to me. I'm really self-conscious about speaking languages. So I don't, the only time I feel free to make a grammatical mistake is if I'm dreaming.
Mm.
Yeah, Spanish I'm proficient enough. I can like pick up whole books and read them, but I'm really so self-conscious that I rarely, I guess if I were dropped in a country, I guess I would, you know, if I went to Spain for a couple weeks, I would finally break down and speak Spanish. But I mean, I have friends who speak Spanish. I don't speak Spanish too. So it's not, I'm just too self-conscious to do it, but I dream in it all the time. It's totally possible, but yes, it happens.
It's been a while. I think I haven't had as many dreams where I dream in language. I think after I'd learned Mandarin and my French was still floating around somewhere in the background, I kind of reached a point where I stopped dreaming in a particular language and it just was something unhinged from language. And I wouldn't think about what language was happening in the dream. There are times where I do feel that self-consciousness about speaking. Even when you know the language well, there are some times where you don't always feel comfortable opening your mouth to speak it.
Well, and speaking English, you're so, or you should be, really sensitive about idiomatic language.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember taking a Spanish exam. My professor was from Argentina, and so the use of the verb coger, which is to catch, is a very different thing in Argentina versus, I forget where this other woman was, but the verb was really in Spain, in Argentina, it was more like, I'm gonna go catch the bus. And in, I forget where this one was from, it's more like to catch an STD, to contract. So she looked at me with this look of horror as I'm talking to her. And I'm like, but did I not say this correctly? And she's like, okay, I guess. Yeah, it's like you have to be very sensitive to not just connotation, not just like the actual denoted language, but the connotation as well. And that's where I fall flat because I don't spend enough time with native speakers. Yeah, and I just came back from Denmark, and it's like it was a very, which I think is just a fascinating language in the first place. But having like read books and whatever, I never used it. It's Scandinavia. Everyone speaks English. Why did I even bother looking at it? When I would listen to conversations, at some point I'm walking through the streets and this woman stops. She's like, "Do you speak Danish?" And there's an emergency, and I don't. And I'm like, "I'm very, very sorry." And she goes somewhere else, and I felt so ashamed that I couldn't help her.
Mm.
And that just comes from a very human place of wanting to reach out and understand.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one day I'll speak Danish too. I don't know. I doubt it. They don't have that many words though. Their words are very, very terse language.
Terse as in, sentences are completed much more simply, or vocabulary is more limited. You simply have a smaller pool of words to draw.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, and it does not do what, you know, like that thing that German does where they compound, and the compounding may, you know, adds emphasis here and there. No, it's a very limited, like, you know, it's an interesting, yeah, it's a very interesting language. Yeah. It's very straightforward. I think it's deceptive. I don't really, I mean, I haven't spent enough time with it to know, like, its true musicality or anything. So it's interesting to me.
So how many languages?
Languages are built is interesting to me, obviously.
Yeah, how many languages have you, you know, on some level encountered or tried to learn at different points? Speaking of human languages as opposed to computer languages.
Okay, human languages, just probably English, Spanish, English, Spanish, French, German, and I guess the recent foray into Danish.
Mm.
Yeah, a pretty straightforward, regular, normal. Computer languages is a whole different thing. That's just legion. That's pretty much people throw me a code and I kind of figure out, okay, is this, what is this? What language is this? Okay, let's work it out.
Mm-hmm.
It's got rules. Let's figure out what the rules are. How do I, you know, tons and tons and tons of computer languages that I probably are best forgot. But but yeah, there's like Delphi and whatever. Delphi, Fortran, Lisp, thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
The .NET, you know, things, C++, you know, most of the things I work are, and now I'm like working, I work usually in SQL. I work in, you know, databases usually. So I'm in SQL 98% of the time, even if I'm, you know, interfacing with some other language that captures that, Java, whatever. So all of those things kind of come together and you discover how you need to think systematically. I'm at the point in my career that I think outside the language that I'm working in. I'm really thinking about what does the compiler do?
Yeah.
What are the interactions with the compiler? I've moved to this very different place about how I troubleshoot. I troubleshoot on the layers. Where can this error be coming from? I think of it more on the systematic level than I do on this particular line of code. And that, and I can actually look at behavior, and sometimes I can watch the behavior of something running and go, oh, you know, it's probably here, and I'm right probably 60 or 70% of the time. I actually walked by a QA person once and asked why someone was throwing something into an array. And she just looked at me, and she's like, how do you know? I'm like, that's just kind of the behavior. It's kind of stuttering right there. It probably shouldn't be doing that. They would have all the data back if they called the database. And they were calling them, like, throwing something into an array they shouldn't, because it was more data than they anticipated.
Yep.
But I just, it's having been around it long enough, I can tell.
So it's interesting. It sounds like it's that familiarity with languages. With so many languages, you start to think in this. It's a metalinguistics. It's a thinking
you live,
of.
You live outside of it.
Yeah,
I think absolutely.
There's a interesting anecdote. I had a professor years ago when I was an undergraduate. I had a professor who was a professor of religion and ancient languages, and he could read or speak 27 different languages. And he said with such a deadpan face, we never knew if he was being like direct with us or if he was deliberately kind of pulling our leg. But he said, like, after the first 6 or 7, the rest start making sense.
Wow.
But I can kind of see his point, because there's a point where you study enough languages that you start to understand, like, basic strategies and architectures and not even that, just sort of impulses. Like, this language tries to do things this way. This other language that you encounter, you can see how it's been influenced by this earlier language and how it, like, contributes to some of the things that it does. But at the same time, it's clear that it's also been impacted by this language. I mean, English is full of those artifacts of all the languages it's encountered.
And it's a language of dominion, really.
Yeah, it's a Borg. You know, it's a Borg language of, you know, it conquers and it assimilates, it appropriates, it transforms.
Yeah.
Sometimes it overwrites, and, like, you know, English is a virus, I guess. But,
well, sometimes it overwrites and writes back, where you have, like, you know, it's like people saying, you know, like, computadora in Spanish, for example, which I'm sure there are probably better ways with the root languages that Spanish has to say computer, but it just kind of writes back to other languages as well, which I think is interesting, where you have these English cognates that come back to other languages.
Yeah, I mean, Japanese borrows heavily from you know, English, and it simply just transliterates certain terms and makes it into, you know, something that sounds Japanese but is really, you know, just English through a filter. Mm. But Chinese has, you know, does some transliteration, but other things are so uniquely and cleverly their own. I love, speaking of computers, in Chinese, when you want to refer, in Mandarin, if you want to refer to a computer, it's dianao. It's electric brain, which is beautiful. I was like, I love the idea that the computer is an electric brain, because it is. And
yeah, it is. Exactly. It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So, stores things that remembers things. Yes, absolutely. So, I do think, actually, going back to this idea of like the first, you know, six or seven languages, they all become the same and you know them all. I do think with software languages, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because they have about, almost, not always, but almost about the same rules. They want to accomplish the same things. I have no problem learning different software languages at all.
Yeah, most languages fall into one of like maybe four or five different models. You know, there's like languages that look like C and C++, and then there are languages that look like Lisp and Scheme, and then there are languages that, you know, work in these other ways. But they're all kind of, you know, they're all like, once you recognize which model it falls under, you can probably figure out its basic workings fairly quickly.
You'll work it out. Like, once you figure out, it's like, okay, even down to, okay, this is equivalence. All right, let's start with the equivalences, and then let's start with, see exactly, like, this is an equivalence, and this is, some kind of object and something acting on an object. Mm-hmm. And you can slowly work from there. This is a string operation, which kind of all languages work on strings, give or take, kind of the same. They have their own syntax, but they pretty much, you know, parse strings about the same way.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of things that have great departures for string parsing, and I don't do. Although I do have to say that I remember all the time spent doing problem set string parsing, when you're like, I don't believe we'll ever have to use this. I use that all the time. All the time.
Yeah.
Like, most of my time is probably spent transforming some string somehow. So I guess that's for people who are taking, you know, people who are taking CS. That is, you did a lot of it because you're going to do a lot of it.
You're going to do a lot of it. It's important.
It's really interesting to me, actually, that over time, I having chosen, you know, the field that I work in, I somehow didn't think of the end game of, like, what would happen after about 20 years in a field. Mm-hmm. And knowing that you're like, oh, I got to learn something new. I guess that's why we work. And you just kind of roll with it. Mm-hmm. In a way that I don't know if other fields have the kind of volatility that our fields do, and the kind of needs for us to keep up with every single change that has to happen.
Yeah, I think it's most fields are move much more glacially. You know, it takes longer for changes to happen. There are some, actually, in terms of language, I think of something my mother once told me about Cantonese, which is, Cantonese is an odd language because it's very much a street language, a language that is in constant use in business and in trade and on the street by everyday people in Hong Kong. So it's a language that is constantly evolving and responding to what's happening. And so my mother said that if she did not stay in conversation with people who had recently been in Hong Kong, within about 7 years, her language would become not quite obsolete, but she would be out of touch with it would be stale. It would not be current at all. So it didn't take more than about like five, six, 7 years to kind of fall out. Whereas a lot of, you know, once you learn, let's say, C++, it's not like C++ is going to radically change in 7 years.
What I will say is this, though. Approaches, data approaches, architectural approaches, I have been around long enough to watch the large, the cycle go. And you see an entire cycle where first, you know, we go from, you know, this whole sense of, all right, we're going to just write things to files. And then, okay, let's have an RDBMS to have atomic transactions. And then what we need is one very, very large computer to run different sub-schemes. And you kind of slowly walk through the 70s and 80s, and all of a sudden we're back to something called cloud computing, which is really, yeah, it's big. It's like, that's a big blue kind of idea. Like the fact that you have these sub-processes that are all right back to one, you know, one controlled kind of, you have that whole, there was a whole, like, all the rage was client-server computing for a while, where you have, you know, these things that write back to a central place. And then we, we also have, on the other side of that, we also have this kind of NoSQL movement, which never really works because you have to have, you know, atomic transactions. That's why we spent 40 years trying to get an atomic transaction. But, like, you watch these things kind of go in cycles, and what's going to be, you know, the greatest fad in, you know, data architecture or application architecture. That goes up and down. But I mean, I've learned kind of just to sit back in my pocket and watch what that's going to look like over time and really learn from my mistakes. I've gotten better only because I've made a lot of mistakes, and then slowly kind of going, oh, yeah, that's pretty awful. That's probably a really bad idea, because back in fill in the blank 1995, I did blah, blah, blah. So I'm turned into this old, I'm not even that old, but I'm turned into this old geezer. It's like back in my day, or I had like an old boss who was like, back in my day, we still had punch cards, you know? It's a very strange feel that kind of reveres youth, but it's not necessarily rewarded. It's like in the same way. Like, I think youth, like that sense of youth, and, you know, we have this veneer of we need to have, you know, it's a young field when you really need veterans. I think
that is one of the ongoing, you know, struggles within that field in terms of like who HR wants to hire. They want to hire the fresh face, the worship, the sort of the vitality of the young, the innovation of the young, but forget that in most companies they're dependent on systems that are old and architectures that are old and code that's old. That requires someone with a deep understanding of the history and the evolution. In a sense, and this is maybe a little bit awkwardly done, but it brings us back to the idea of restoring these hardwood floors at the beginning.
Exactly.
That there is a way in which you have to, you know, be familiar enough with the history that's present to recognize what is worth salvaging and what needs to be removed. And what needs to be transformed so that it can be fully functional and beautiful again.
I also kind of have this sense of being able to recognize them when you see them, recognize the tail of it when you see it. And because a lot of times, because there's this reverence for youth in this field, you often, you know, veterans go. And so you have to look for these artifacts. Particularly in code, or like, you know, if you've been in a large development team, you can look at code, and I could tell. I remember this one point, I could tell immediately who wrote the code by just the style.
Yeah.
Sometimes just the indents. Sometimes they use the same algorithms every time, but I could tell just by the flavor. And that's absolutely transitive to looking at a floor. What does this floor need? Oh, it looks like this thing has happened to it.
Yeah.
Because you can just vaguely see, like, oh, there's like a buildup over here. They probably have done these things. Let's try that first.
Well, it's been absolutely wonderful to have this conversation.
It's always great talking.
Dare I say, your obsession floors me. But no, it's been wonderful, and it's been wonderful too to delve into sort of the evolution and the history of programming, which was kind of a delight to walk back into. We would love to hear you read something. Do you have maybe one or two poems that you could?
I do. I'll start with this one, and it's called "The Burgomaster Said I Could Do Whatever I Wanted to You." And then added, "I will turn my back and look away." But as you entered the room, shuffling and jangling your chains and smelling of day after day after day of yourself, I thought of forgiveness, which is to say, I thought of myself. I stood without a word to offer. And then I remembered fire, and the fires we fled, the night after day after night in darkness, and the girl screaming her dying, the baby you left on the grass, crying and crying until it didn't, and then the growling of the dogs. And all the while you were silent and watching me as you'd always been. And as I turned to leave, I thought to myself, I can look away. I can choose to give you nothing. I can still save myself. Save myself. And the last poem I have, this poem I wrote, is predicated on the conditional. So it's called The Peonies at the Bodega. Were this a poem, and I were just arranging the sound, we would be standing in rain and not snow. I would have left intact, I would have left on foot, and I would have gathered my coat against weather. I would not hail a taxi. I would not raise my hand against the glass as if to gesture against morning. And you would not be left standing alone near the hothouse flowers at the bodega near Hot Mott and Broom. When we made love that afternoon, we would have taken all our clothes off. You would have removed your left sock, for example. In the poem I would write, the woman in the street would not have noticed how much we loved or that we fairly glowed with it. Nor would they bustle by, cluck-clucking and smiling knowingly. In the poem, you would have hailed the cab yourself, opened the door, and then shut me up in it. I would have kept my eyes forward. I would not have watched you grow smaller and smaller through the rear window, and you would not have waved and waved and waved. In the poem, it would be near dusk, and there would be some kind of metaphor about how even the earth participates in the end of things. I mentioned the owner of the bodega were an old married couple, restocking the produce to guard against decay. I'd mention the flowers, and they would be peonies, and peonies would stand in for something else.
Thank you so much, TJ, for being a part of this show. If people want to learn, I guess, what's the best way that people can reach you?
I'm Googleable under TJ Jarrett. Also, my I do have links, and I try to keep updated my most recent publications that are at least on the web. It's tjjarrett.com. I try to keep that as updated as possible. Thank you for having me, Neil.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lit Fantastic. Our guest today was TJ Jarrett, poet and software developer from Nashville, Tennessee, who is the author of two collections of poetry, Ain't No Grave from New Issues Press, and her most recent collection, Zion, published by Southern Illinois University Press and winner of the Crab Orchard Open Competition. For more information about TJ and her work, visit her online at www.tjjarrett.com. That's www.tjjarrett.com. You can find previous episodes of The Lit Fantastic on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, www.thelitfantastic.com. They're also available on the kboo.fm archive. Until next time, I'm your host, Neil Akin. Goodbye. Au revoir. Sayonara. Zaijian. Arrivederci.
KBOO Community Radio is volunteer-powered. We have a dynamic community of 500 volunteers doing everything from front desk work, janitorial work, community reporting, hosting information booths, clerical support, news writing, documentary making, operating soundboards, engineering and computer help, website upkeep, and many, many other things. To become a KBOO volunteer, come to our next monthly volunteer orientation, on Tuesday, August 7th at 6 p.m. at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/volunteer.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Call Mr. Robeson on Friday, August 10th at 7:30 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. Call Mr. Robeson is a play that portrays African-American actor and singer Paul Robeson's remarkable life, highlighting his pioneering and heroic political activism. Features Old Man River and other famous songs, much fiery oratory, and a defiant testimony to the House Un-American Activities Committee. Again, that's Call Mr. Robeson on Friday, August 10th at 7:30 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Radio Theater Project. Theater of the mind for today. Comedies and dramas, mysteries and science fiction, old stories and new. Radio Theater Project. Theater of the mind for today.
This is Future Past radio dramas adapted from the golden age of science fiction, this time presenting The Mystery of the Void, Part 1. Written in 1959 at the beginning of the space age, this is a story of mystery and adventure in the far-off asteroid belt.